The following presentation was recorded at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Malvern East, Australia. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
So, hello people on YouTube. I can't see you, but I'm glad you're there. And I'm happy everyone's here, and I'm happy to be here in my old town, Melbourne. I used to go to school not far away. Are we in Malvern, right?
Yeah.
Yes. I went to school at Sacre Coeur. Burke Road, Glen Iris. For my whole 12 years at school, I went there to the nuns. So I want to start with a little prayer. I'm going to sing it in Tibetan. Basically, it's the first two lines are expressing our refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, but the second two lines are kind of like the Tibetans say, state your motivation for what you do. We might say, well, state your purpose. What are we doing here? We're going to be, you know, I'm going to be talking and you'll ask questions and we'll discuss Buddha's teachings, and what is it? It's advice, basically, isn't it, of how to put ourselves together to become these marvellous people, and so we can be a benefit to others, you know? That's the bottom line, isn't it? So we think this words I'm going to be saying, hopefully we can hear it as advice, so maybe hear it so we can develop our marvellous potential so we can help others, because we're all in the same boat, you know? I'll just sing a little prayer in Tibetan. Sangye chadang tsokhe chognam la jang chu badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chun yen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shok Sangye chadang tsokhe chognam la jang chu badu dagni kyab su chi dagi chun yen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shok Sangye chadang tsokhe chognam la Changchu baru dagni kyab suchi Dagi chonyen gipe sonam ki Drola penchir sangge drupa shok. Okay. Well, you know, there's a nice saying, I think the bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. Or, you know, so the wisdom wing is really all the nuts and bolts of Lord Buddha's teachings that we hear in the Four Noble Truths, that give us the methods of how to put ourselves together. Speaking very simply, isn't it? How to know our own mind, how to realize what is suffering, that we want, you know, want to get rid of suffering because we're sick of it. And on the basis of this, you put yourself together, even if you forget about even achieving nirvana, just even a little bit of putting yourself together, a bit of clarity, a bit of steadiness, a bit of equanimity, then already we can then look around and go, oh my God, we're all in the same boat, you know? So then you want to help others. But it's really obvious that you know, I remember the Dalai Lama says, compassion is not enough. You need wisdom. So wisdom is a bit of a grand word, maybe. But what it really means is, you know, when we understand the Buddha's view, which is why that we suffer because of attachment and anger and fears and jealousy and neurosis. I mean, we're totally miserable. So one of the consequences of that is indeed our misery. But the other thing is it causes us to live in la-la land. We can't see past our own nose. So, you know, and there's no way we can really help other people because we're just seeing everything through the lenses of our own needs. So by working on your own mind first, you know, steadying yourself, you become more content, but you also become more clear because you remove some of the rubbish from your mind. So now we can see others more clearly, you know. So compassion is not enough. We need to have some clarity ourselves first. And that's kind of obvious. I mean, if you say, how can I help my children learn music? Of course you can hire another teacher, but how can I help my children learn music? It's obvious, you've got to learn music yourself. So how can I help my children, you know, or my next door neighbor or my sister, if I don't know my own mind, if I don't understand what attachment is, if I don't understand what aversion is, if I don't understand depression and jealousy and low self-esteem are, these neuroses, these afflictions, you know, these delusions that Buddha points out, if I don't understand those in myself, how can I possibly help others? I can't, you know. So it's very obvious. We have to the degree that I can put myself together is the degree to which I can be useful to others. And we all want that. We live in this crazy world together. And if we can't be effective for others and help a dog and a human and an auntie, we're in big trouble, you know. So we all know, too, the teachings are kind of like logical progression, aren't they? The very first level of practice for the Buddha, we can see this. Don't even worry about your mind yet. Control the servants of your mind. Control your body and control your speech. In our culture, we kind of don't like that. It sounds like someone's kind of sitting on top of us and suppressing us, you know. Be a nice person. But it's very logical. This is where we learn about Lord Buddha's view about karma, this natural law that runs the universe, basically, you know. So I think something about karma, I think it's important that we really get this clear. I think we're so used to, you know, if we think in our world about religious philosophy, most of us, I suppose, unless we've come from a Buddhist culture, but us white people, certainly me, I've come from a Christian culture, you know, and that, of course, means religion means God. Religion means creator. So even though we know Buddha's not a creator, I think it's really important to spell it out. Because when we hear that Jesus says don't kill and don't steal and don't lie, well, so does Buddha. They both got their little list of 10 don'ts, don't they? And we can hear it in the same way. And I think we hear it in a punitive way. Like, if you do this, you get punished. I think that's a very deep view in our mind. But if you analyze the Buddha's teachings really logically, which we should, Buddha is not a creator. Buddha is not a punisher. Buddha is not a rewarder. There is no concept like that. Sure, Lord Buddha's got his own views as he grew up and as he began to develop his community. He would announce you don't do this and you don't do that in communities. But when it comes to what they call natural negativities about lying and stealing and killing, you know, it's very, very different from the Christian teachings. And we should really point this out if we like Buddha's teachings. I've got this Jesuit priest friend, right? And I asked him, tell me that what defines something as wrong for a Christian, as a sin, in other words, or as a negative action? And this is a really crucial point. If we want Buddhism, we should be clear about these things. Because the way we hear Buddha's instructions is really crucial. So he said, a sin by definition is doing what God said not to do. And that's pretty tasty. And if we have the view of a creator who runs the universe, who creates the universe, who then punishes and rewards, which is the view, then of course it's correct. That would make sense, you know. But the Buddha, you ask him what makes killing wrong. He will tell you it's got nothing to do with the fact that he says it. He's not a creator. He didn't make it up. He doesn't run the show. He's not a boss. He's not a creator. He's not a punisher. He's not a rewarder. We have to remember these things. We hear it in the same way because we get guilty, you know. We're naughty. We're going to get punished. That's very much a part of ego, actually. But it's really important to remember this. You know, Buddha gives the same instructions, but it's for a very different reason. He says what makes killing wrong is, guess what? It's a natural law. People don't like being killed. That's kind of powerful. But what's interesting, though, as we all know, but this is the point, when he exhorts us right at the very first stages of practice not to steal, kill, lie, jump on the wrong partner, same as Jesus, the reason he exhorts us not to do those things, he defines them as negative because they harm others. But the reason at the beginning, especially, that he exhorts us don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, and I think certainly in our modern culture, we just don't hear this properly. He is because, guess what, Rabina, if you kill and you steal and you lie and you badmouth, you are programming yourself to become a horrible person. So forget lower realms in the future lives, even just this life, you know. So the point here is, I think it's so tasty, we've got to really point it out, because when we hear about karma, we hear it in exactly the same way. Oh, I shouldn't do this and I shouldn't do that, and we assume if I get caught, I'm a naughty girl and I'll get punished. I think that is, unless we really unpack that view, that's our dualistic view of religious philosophy, you know, and it's kind of like a bit infantile. Buddha's telling us we have not been created by anybody. He does not have that concept. He argues philosophically with it. He's not trying to be rude, but we know very well. We shouldn't just say, oh yeah, Buddha doesn't talk about a creator. We should be able to unpack it, you know, logically. I mean, he came out of that amazing system, these genius Indians. I mean, the Dalai Lama always says this: these amazing Indians more than 3,000 years ago who were the ones who began the investigation into the nature of self, right? And so Lord Buddha went as far as he could go in that system, but he could see they hadn't gone far enough, which is his view, in relation directly to the nature of self, which is how come when he diverged in his own direction, directly in relation to his own experiential findings about the nature of self, and he, of course, came up with selflessness. That's where he diverged in his own degrees. And that's where you posit no creator and no, because the concept of a creator, this external person who runs the universe, is the same philosophically as the concept of a self or a soul or an I that runs the person. It's the same philosophy, you know. It's very fascinating. We should look into it properly. Buddha would assert there's no such thing. We don't need creating. As the Dalai Lama says, this law of karma, which has been around since these Indians, they're the ones who observed it first, before the Buddha. He agrees with it. That everything we think and do and say, every millisecond of what we think and do and say, including the monkeys and the ants, produces the person we become. I mean, the concept of it is very simple and it's very delicious, really. I mean, in a sense, Buddha's saying we're the boss. We create ourselves. Not in a kind of magic wand sense, but in an evolutionary sense, that whatever we think and say and do is the process that produces the person I become. But I think we really miss that. We hear it as kind of punitive. We hear it as punishment. We hear it as reward. That's how we talk about it, you know. Most people, when you think about karma, it just sounds like Jesus, another variation. It's profoundly and totally different, actually. Well, it's really important we understand this if we say we like being a Buddhist. Because applying the law of karma is the starting point. Forget your meditation. I mean, the very first level of practice is control the servants of your mind. Why? Because we're driven by attachment and delusions and neuroses. It's too hard to look into your mind first. You've got to calm your body and your speech down, live in vows, live a disciplined life, calm yourself down, control the body and the speech. This is profound already. And then we have the miracle of space to start to delve deep into our minds in the way Buddha's describing, to unpack and unravel the contents here so we can see what causes us suffering and we can see then how to solve the problem, you know. It's such practical psychology. But our trouble is because we hear it, you know, when you hear, I mean, certainly the Tibetans, when I first heard the teachings from Lama Zopa back in the mid-70s up at Chenrezig Institute, I mean, it might as well have been that he was talking, you know, I mean, he was talking, you know, this particular lineage of practices in Tibet, 14th century, medieval. You might as well have been speaking in the same language. And it's good that it was kept intact because they kept it pure. But somehow it seems so arcane when we hear it. It's hard for us to hear the Buddha's teachings unless to hear it as practical psychology. And that's not meant to be insulting psychology or indeed Buddha, because Buddha deals with the mind. He doesn't talk about a soul, does he? He doesn't talk about a spirit. He talks about the mind. And that's Buddha's expertise. And again, this comes from these Indians. I mean, in the incredible literature, in the Buddhist literature about the mind, which is shared by all the traditions, it's the same system, you know, the texts about the mind are incredibly sophisticated. I mean, most of us mightn't study it, but the view of the mind as articulated by the Buddha coming from these genius Indians is incredibly fascinating. So, of course, Buddha's not talking about the brain. He's talking about the internal cognitive process itself. But basically, we've got to control our body and speech first, which is why we should live in vows and be happy to, not just think that vows are squashing you. I'm a naughty person. I shouldn't do this. No, it's really good discipline to harness our own body and speech so we can then have the luxury of the ability to really then be able to, you know, look into our mind and identify what Buddha's saying are the causes of our pain, you know. I mean, it's just logical stuff. It's so important we hear it like this. But it's crucial, like I'm saying, to hear it not coming from the idea of a creator. I mean, I remember very well, it was really brilliant actually, in New Zealand one year, this guy, who he actually was a scientist, it was the only time I've ever had this question, it was fascinating. He said, who revealed the teachings to the Buddha? Which is a perfect question if you are talking about creative religious philosophy, which he assumed was the same for Buddhism. That is coming from on high, from revelation. I mean, this is so fascinating. And I said, well, would you ask Einstein who revealed the teachings about relativity to him? And of course, everybody laughed. But we have to realize Lord Buddha is exactly the same as Einstein. This is not being sarcastic or silly. If he's not a creator, then where do you think this information came from? He didn't look in the sky. He didn't have a dream. He wasn't under a tree with a revelation coming from somewhere. He used his own intelligence. We've got to remember this, you know. This is a very powerful point. We're so used to religious philosophy being holy, beyond, mystical, can't prove it, which, of course, is a creative religion view. And it's right you can't prove God is right. If you can prove God is right, you are God. And that's the worst sin you can possibly have. But Buddha's different. We've got to remember this. I'm not trying to say he's better. It's your decision. But if we are liking Buddhism, we've got to unpack it like this and realize where these instructions are coming from. They're not instructions like, if you don't do this, you'll get punished, which is how we think of God. That's how we think of these punitive things. Don't kill, don't steal, don't lie. Why? Because I'll get punished. That's how we hear it. But if you went to your doctor, Buddha's more like your doctor. You go to your doctor and she says, well, Bina, you better not smoke, babe. And I say, why not? We know she won't say, because I say so. And if you smoke, Rabina, I'm going to punish you with cancer. We would laugh at that as being infantile. But that's how we hear religious philosophy. because it's instinctive in our mind. So we've got to really look at our minds carefully and hear this stuff properly. It's really important, you know. Otherwise, we just, I mean, Buddha's not a creator, and it's not the same relationship. It's quite different. It doesn't mean you can't revere Buddha, have total faith in Buddha, nothing wrong. You can have faith in your doctor, you can revere your doctor, but you know your doctor's giving you advice based on her intelligence. She's observed the natural law that if you smoke, it could cause you cancer, you know. And then you're delighted at her kindness. You don't go, oh, I'm not supposed to smoke, she's going to punish me. I mean, this is how ego works, actually. It's kind of ironic, you know. So we've got to really look at this carefully. And my feeling is this is where guilt comes in. We all know about guilt. Guilt's like the worst sin against ourselves, I tell you. And if you really analyze it, okay, you know, to understand guilt, I think we have to understand attachment. And we all know that, you know, Buddha talks, he says effectively in the Four Noble Truths, attachment's the main cause of our suffering. So guilt is something we are very familiar with, and I think it's related to this idea of being don't do that because you'll get punished. So but look at the root of it. Let's go into attachment for a second. This is the root one. If we can really get this one, forget understanding anatma, forget that. But basically, the main voice of ego is attachment, and it's multifaceted, I tell you. So one, we know that there's attachment to sex and attachment to food and attachment to the sense objects. That's evident. And we calm ourselves down in initial stages and don't eat too much cake and don't jump on your husband too many days, whatever. Calm your body and speech down. But the deeper level of attachment is very primordial. It's very fascinating. And I think that attachment is very linked to the way ego works. Is this, since we're born, this craving to be seen in a good light. This hunger, this attachment, like an emotional hunger, you know, deep in our bones, that we want to be approved of by others. We want to be seen to be a good girl. So since we're born, think about it, we've internalized, mummy says don't do this, and daddy says don't do that, and God says don't do this, and grandma says don't do that, and the government says don't do this. So we internalize this don't do, and because we want to be seen to be a good girl, we've got it all programmed, and then as soon as you break the cup, mummy's not even in the kitchen, you look around to check who saw me do it, and then you go, oh, I'm a bad girl, I broke the cup. I mean, it's kind of... And then what we do is then we exaggerate our badness. And guilt is a very neurotic state of mind. It's really like anger against yourself, you know. I did this and I did that and I'm a bad person. But what we're using is this wish to be seen as a good girl. So we don't even wait for mummy to punish us. We just punish ourselves. So it's really quite a neurotic state of mind. And it really is like anger. And I think we've got to unpack all this stuff, because what Buddha's really telling us is that we are responsible. If there's no creator, then of course we're responsible. Who else is, you know? It's really important to understand that. And that in a way, we become more grown up when we can have the view of karma, use it as our basis for living our lives, as like a guideline. You become your own boss. You become your own judge. You don't have to be into doing this and doing that, and if I'm a naughty girl, I'll get punished. Not like that. It's a much more grown-up attitude, really. But we've got to really look at it carefully. And the fact of the matter is, all Buddha's saying is, he says don't kill, don't steal, don't jump on someone else's partner. Because why? Because guess what, Robina? People don't like getting harmed. That's what a negative action is, like I said. But you've got to remember, the reason, especially at the beginning when he exhorts us not to kill, isn't so much because of compassion for the person, but it's like compassion for yourself. Buddha doesn't talk that way, but it's a really good phrase. We use that in our culture. Buddha's basically saying, if you kill Robina and steal and lie and badmouth and get angry and upset and have attachment, body, speech and mind, if you program your mind in that, guess what kind of person you are producing? A miserable, unhappy person. Forget future lives, okay? It's really a practical thing. So this attitude of karma is so empowering, actually. All Buddha's doing is he's giving his explanation of the things that you can use as your guidelines to help you become a less neurotic, suffering person. That's the first one. And that's really what he means by renunciation. Giving up suffering and its causes. Who's suffering? My suffering. So it really is like what we'd say is self-compassion. But we hear it as punitive, as someone squashing me. I'm a naughty girl. I'll get punished. We've got to think about these things. You know, it's really important. I mean, I know when I first heard the teachings about karma, I mean, I'd been brought up a Catholic, just down the road. My school was down the road, I said. I loved God. I loved Our Lady. I loved going to Mass every day. I wanted to be a priest, you know. I was so little. I didn't understand the reason. They said, I'm not a boy. I was puzzled, you know. They said I had to be a nun. I said, oh, all right. So only when I was 12, my mother sent me to boarding schools. I was so naughty, but I wanted to be a nun again. I lived at Sacré Cœur. And I was on my knees in the kitchen. I was 12, I think. And I begged my mother to let me be a nun like Saint Therese of Lisieux, that little Catholic saint who suffered for God, you know. And, of course, I cried when she said no. And then 20 years later, I told her I'm going to be a Buddhist nun. She cried. And I said, oh, Mum, it's all the same. And she said, well, if it's all the same, why did you change? Which is a very intelligent answer. Anyway, whatever. But, I mean, yeah, I love God and blah, blah, blah. So I think this one of karma, when I first heard it from Lama Zopa, I didn't know much of the meaning of it, but I knew that that had been missing in my life. I really like the view. I really like this view that, you know, we come into this life programmed with our own tendencies. I mean, of course, we have to take the view here that our consciousness is not physical. It doesn't come from a creator. We're not the handiwork of mummy and daddy. Mummy and daddy influence us, but they do not give us a mind. They do not give me a mind. This is a really crucial point, you know. And we're all Westerners, we're all modern people, so we all take on board modern psychology. But mummy and daddy give us a brain, yes, but not a mind, not tendencies, not my love and my compassion and my being good at music and football. They are my tendencies that I bring with me. It's one of the ways karma ripens, you know. So having that view, even just taking it as your hypothesis, and of course until you're highly advanced you can't prove it to be true, but it's a great theory, then the view is already you're taking responsibility. So instead of this view that we feel of self-pity, I didn't ask to get born, it's not my fault, which is how we feel, you know, that you take this view that you, your own mind is yours, whatever you meet is yours, your experiences are yours, and you are the main creator of them. I mean, this view for me is so delicious because it demands being grown up. You take responsibility, and it's liberating. It's not squashing, it's liberating. It annihilates guilt, it annihilates attachment, you lessen the anger, you lessen the fears, you learn to take responsibility, you know. In this ordinary life, forget about a nirvana. On the way there, it really encourages us to take responsibility, to own our own thoughts and tendencies. And that's why guilt is not taking responsibility. Guilt is like self-blame and it's like getting off the hook, you know. It's not my fault, you know, poor me. So it's very powerful karma. I mean, you know, I haven't read all the old texts where they all comes from, but it's just incredible view to really think about. It really, as His Holiness says, it's like self-creation. This is very tasty, you know. There's no one else to blame. We create ourselves in this evolutionary sense. Karma is like personal evolution, it seems to me, you know. And this is the starting point. This is the basis. And again, where did these instructions come from? From Lord Buddha. And where did he get it from? Guess what? Just like Einstein, from using his own intelligence and observing the universe. So obviously his mind is more subtle. I mean, he was able to have shamatha, this genius technique these Indians invented, getting samadhi, getting your mind go to a subtler level. So with that subtle level of mind, you can observe the world, observe the minds of beings, and observe this natural law called the law of karma. It's not coming from on high. It is not made up by anybody, and it is not run by anybody. We've got to spell it out like this, you know. But it's like just botany. It's a natural law. There's no big kind of boss botany who runs botany, you know. It's just botanists have observed it. Well, Buddha has observed the law of karma. He labels it the law of karma. This, that everything any being thinks and says and does produces that person. I mean, it's hardly rocket science, you know. That's why it's so important to sort of put in fresh words sometimes. I just repeat the texts. We just, we become a bit sort of like not thinking about it. I find that so important, you know. And when we really begin to abide by the laws of karma, we are the beneficiaries of it. It's just like your doctor says, abide by the laws of proper nutrition and don't smoke and don't eat sugar. You are the beneficiary. It's not punishment and reward. You are the beneficiary. That's the attitude, you know. And this instinct of ego to hide things when we're naughty is very strong. Kind of like guilt is sort of, if no one saw me do it, oh, phew, I got away with it, you know. Well, with the law of karma, it's a bizarre idea. You can't get away with anything because it's a natural law. And this is the same with your doctor. If you had this view of your doctor telling you not to smoke because, you know, you'll suffer, but then you go home and you notice your doctor's not there, so out come the Marlboros. Oh, I won't get cancer, my doctor doesn't see me. I mean, you would be laughed at. But that's how we think of religious philosophy. That's how we think of karma, same as Jesus, you know. It's ridiculous. It's not like that. You have to become accountable. There's a lovely saying we say, my mother would say, you become your own person. Not this constant, and this is where this attachment to reputation, attachment to being approved of, is the deepest attachment we'll have, I think, if you look at it. It's more than for sex and drugs and rock and roll. This craving to be approved of by others. That's powerful. With a creator, you need to be approved of by God. You must be. So Buddha would approve of you. He's a nice person. But his approval of you is not what makes you a better person. Do you understand my point? It's, you know, we want to make Buddha happy maybe, but you are the one who is the beneficiary. It's a very powerful concept. You become your own boss, you know. It doesn't matter who sees you smoke cigarettes. You'll get cancer if you smoke. It doesn't matter who sees you kill or steal or lie. It's going to program your mind with those tendencies. And who wants that? So it demands like a sense of accountability. And that's what I find. I love the view of karma. I think it's an amazing presentation of the way the world is, you know, a law that, and Buddha says it, it's the law that runs the universe, the law within which the universe runs, and it's a natural law. I keep having to say that. It's so important. Not Buddha's law. It's natural law. Buddha has observed it, and we can observe it too. That's your starting point. And then you've got the space to go deep into your mind and see the neuroses and see the attachment and see the anger. And these are so powerful. I mean, in our modern psychology, we don't talk about attachment and anger. You don't go to your therapist, oh, I got attached today. She'll tell you to shut up and go home when you want to kill your husband, you know? I mean, and this is the thing about the Lord Buddha, I think. He gives us these methods, practical mindfulness techniques, that enable us to see our mind at a deeper level before it comes out the mouth, you know. Our problem is in our culture, we've all got anger, we've all got attachment, we've all got neuroses, but we don't know about them because we're not paying attention until they're vomiting out the mouth, until you're fighting with your husband. It's a bit late, you know. So these practical techniques that Buddha gives us, these techniques that we call meditation, whatever, to sit down in for a few minutes and focus your mind, you can't help but hear your thoughts. You can't help but hear all the crazy thoughts, you know. So then you have to become familiar with them because they're why you suffer. So it's not a question of just making them all go away. You've got to become familiar with them. That's why if we're brave enough and you're in the middle of the, you know, the drama in the kitchen and your hubby's slurping his coffee yet again and you're getting annoyed and upset, if you know, can see your mind, see the irritation before it comes out the mouth, that's a simple, practical benefit of having a daily meditation. And I mean really simple. Forget about nirvana, like I said. Just developing a skill to step out of your head for a few minutes. You bring that to bear in your daily life and you can catch yourself. You catch your thoughts at the kitchen sink, driving the car. And whereas once you'd only know you're angry when you're vomiting it out your mouth, now you can catch it before it becomes emotional. That, for me, is a real benefit of a practical daily practice, you know. I said, like I said, forget nirvana, just practical. And we've got to go one step at a time. And this is where I think also the practice of controlling our body and speech is so powerful. We think it kind of sounds boring, you know. Oh, I want to meditate. Sure. But, you know, the one of speech especially. I mean, you look at our lives, okay? Forget the world, but look at our lives. We mightn't go around raping and killing too many people, but look at our speech. I find this very powerful. In my family, excuse me, there were seven kids. My older sister died last year, so now there's six. And we're all similar in age. I mean, 10 years. My mum had eight kids in 10 years or something. So we're all kind of now old, between 70 and 80. And I remember as kids we'd always fight, very volatile. We were always friends, and then we went to school, we'd fight. And then we left home and come back at Christmas and you'd fight. I mean, not that bad, but we'd fight, what sisters do. And then, you know, you talk to Julie and she'll criticise Polly, and I'll talk to Jan and she'll criticise Mary, and my brother will criticise... I mean, it's like you talk behind backs and you argue. We mightn't do the terrible things. But the last many years, somehow, and we're all very different, but somehow these last years, I don't know, 20, 30 or something... I think I'd say there's this unbroken, unspoken agreement between us that when we're together, we do not argue about things we don't agree with. And we're all very volatile people, like bossy and loud like me, okay? I mean it sincerely. But nice people, good people, ethical people. But we make a conscious effort not to go there. And second, we never say bad things about each other to each other behind backs. And all I can tell you, I'm not trying to say we're saints, but this is conscious decision to control speech, which for us in our culture is so boring. You know, oh, I can say what I like, we say. We don't think speech matters. But speech has an incredible effect on people. And we all know once it's out the mouth, it's too late. So all I know is over the years, what that's done is because we're consciously not engaging in the negative, we're not suppressing. It's given the space for more harmony and friendliness and pleasure to exist between us. But you understand my point? I mean, everybody, we all somehow, we're nice people, but look, even if you don't badmouth your family, you badmouth the people at work. Everybody on the planet badmouths politicians. And this is the point that I think is quite shocking. In our culture, because we don't have the view of karma, which is that everything I think and do and say produces me, we don't have that view. We really don't have that view. We say, I can say what I like, meaning it has no effect, which is quite mentally ill, I think. To think that your speech doesn't affect you. In other words, if you sat all day at home and no one hearing you, but you shout and yell at the iPad and shout and yell at the television and shout and yell to yourself about the politicians and the upset, how do you think you'll be by the end of the day? You'll be exhausted and drained and totally miserable. So it's so obvious that speech is harmful, and indeed it can be beneficial, no question. So the point is, what I'm saying is, that if we could just take this seriously, this is controlling your body and speech, then you'll be able to have far better meditation. Then you'll be able to see your mind because you're calming down the servants of your mind. I think, and this is when we really understand this view of karma, the Buddha says, and I think it's evident, that whatever I say and do and think, second by second by second, that is the process that produces me. This is not religious. This is practical science, I promise you. But it's kind of like a revelation. We don't think it like that. We're so used to the, oh, no one sees me do it, I'll get away with it. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, I'm allowed to say what I like. I'm allowed to say to do what I like, we say. I mean, it's very weird, actually, because it shows we don't think that what we think and do and say every second produces me, which is the meaning of karma. Forget future lives. Just this life, even that. Simple, simple. This for me is so practical, you know. And then if you know that, you wouldn't want to have an angry thought. We can't force it to go away, but we'll be taking responsibility for it and really catching our mind and working every day and doing our practices and doing our practices, you know, because we're trying to develop a more happy, fulfilled person. Then you can help others, you know. It's what we call self-compassion. It really is like that. They don't use that phrase, but it's a good way of putting it. Instead of thinking, oh, I'm bad, I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't do that, I'll get punished. It's very instinctive, but it's irrational, quite irrational. We are our own boss. We can be our own person, you know. This is why Buddha's so amazing. He's extraordinary. I mean, Buddha's teachings are incredible. So we've got to really hear it sometimes freshly, you know. Even though I'm talking like a regular Australian here, you know, every word I'm saying is Buddhism. I'm not making anything up here. Just saying it in ordinary words is so important sometimes to do that. And Buddha is this incredible, I mean, the degree of subtlety that the Buddhist view has about the workings of the mind, all in that incredible literature out there, you know, is absolutely phenomenal. It's so extraordinary. It's only really now, I think, people in our culture, you know, and I think the Dalai Lama is a big part of this. All these last 30, 40 years, he's making an incredible effort in really communicating with scientists and thinkers and philosophers and other religions in order to, you know, quietly bring in these views that only now modern people are beginning to appreciate, coming from Buddha and coming from the Indians even before Buddha. We had no knowledge before. We were so ignorant, you know. I mean, I always joke when I say that, as the Dalai Lama said, it was these Indians more than 3,000 years ago who began the investigation into the nature of self. We, you know, if we're European-style white people, we probably thought it was Freud 100 years ago. I mean, we're so arrogant, you know. And it's now really that people are finding this unbelievable sophistication of this brilliant view of the world, the Buddhist view, honestly. And it's so encouraging, scientists now, you know, listening and respecting it. Dalai Lama's done an amazing job, I think, in that area. Others as well, but he's been really at the forefront of it. But it also means for us to think about it, hear it freshly and hear it down to earth way, you know. That's how I think about it. Anyway, I've raved on for a little bit. I think it's about time you ask me questions. Please, ask me a question. Yes.
Yeah. We have a common format whereby we will flip-flop between the questions from the audience here. And so one question from the audience and then one question from the online.
Okay.
And then whichever it is.
Okay,
so maybe we start with the question from the audience here.
Okay, go. Does he want the mic? He needs the mic.
And I'll pass the mic to you.
Okay, good. Thank you so much. Thank you. Wonderful. Just here he is.
Okay.
Yeah. And the person at the back. Right. Yes. Good. Got you. Yes.
Okay. Thank you for your teaching. That's really helpful.
A bit louder, sweetheart.
Oh, thank you for your teaching. That's really helpful.
Good.
I really like your talking. I have two questions. One, I feel I'm a very arrogant person, very pride, very arrogant, and...
I'm afraid I have to say I'm a bit deaf in this ear and I keep forgetting to wear my hearing aids. I just keep forgetting. So you've got to speak a bit louder and more clearly. I'm so sorry. Forgive me.
Okay. So I find I'm a very arrogant person.
And, well, did you see it?
And I want to overcome this. And because of... And thanks to your talking, I realize because I keep it talking about arrogant words. So
so what's the question?
So do you have other suggestions to overcome the
arrogance?
Yes.
You know, I think it's a really good question, actually. I think it's very good that you do admit to it, because I think in our culture, my feeling is most of us wouldn't think we're arrogant. But actually, if we have low self-esteem, I bet everybody put their hand up if you said low self-esteem. That's a bit shocking. Low self-esteem is the flip side of arrogance. So you could argue if we didn't have arrogance, we wouldn't have low self-esteem. So let's just unpack it a bit longer, a bit further, okay? So the key point when you study the Buddhist model of the mind, he's got this key distinction, we know this, between the neurotic, it's just ordinary words, delusional, afflicted, unhappy, disturbing states of mind, attachment, anger, jealousy, arrogance, low self-esteem, whatever you want to call, so many variations. We know them intimately. But then you've got your virtuous states of mind, love, compassion, intelligence, kindness. We know these so, so well. So we know them in an ordinary world psychologically, but Buddha makes this massive distinction between them. Why? Because this first lot, the neurotic ones, are the voices of ego. They're not at the core of our being, and they can be utterly removed. That is the meaning of nirvana, people. Got to remember that. So then this is the stuff we're trying to work on. So then I'm getting to the way to begin to identify these states of mind. First of all, they're quite subtle, and they're mixed together like a big soup with all the good ones. So we can't tell the difference until we start going deep into our minds in meditation. But the key characteristic of the unhappy ones is that they, and this is a key point, they exaggerate. So attachment exaggerates the deliciousness of something. Anger exaggerates the ugliness of something. Arrogance exaggerates the importance of oneself. Now, look at low self-esteem. That exaggerates the lack of importance of oneself. So we go between these up and down like a yo-yo. In other words, a really arrogant person, or even relatively arrogant, even like maybe even you, you're very good to admit to it. Arrogance would mean, and actually we've all got it, it's quite subtle, but we don't like to see it. So if you're with you, when you're with another person, let's say you think you're good at a certain area, and you meet another person who's also good, it's very threatening to us. We feel a bit, if it's arrogance that's running the show, we feel a bit distressed, we're a bit nervous they're going to be better than us. And then if you find a person who's really better than you, what happens is you become deflated and you go down to low self-esteem. Oh, I'm pathetic, I'm hopeless, I'm no good. And so it's extreme. So delusion. They exaggerate. So if you can get to see that aspect, but the one of arrogance, we don't like to admit to it because it feels embarrassing, because we do not think we're arrogant. But I think it's very subtle, because all the time we're always finding fault. This is one of the things. So I think arrogance and anger, they're like twins, you know. We all got anger. And that's the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. Attachment is this emotional hunger that always wants what I want. And then it has a panic attack called aversion when it doesn't get what it wants, which is anger, annoyed, irritated, upset. And then anger also causes us to criticize people. I mean, you can be a nice person walking down the street and you criticize people. Oh, look at her, look at him, look at her. She's fat, she's thin. I don't like her nose, she's this. It's all sort of automatic. You're not being horrible. It's just really automatic. And as soon as you find fault in somebody, right next to it, meaning, oh, I'm more important. Or it's flipped down to low self-esteem. Everybody's better than me. So in a sense, with low self-esteem, we're resentful that people are better than me because I'd rather me be better, although we don't like to say it like that because we take it all personally. You see, when the delusions are there, we take everything personally. So it's really quite subtle. So we've got to catch it. So one of the antidotes to it is to praise somebody else. You understand? You catch it in your mind, and it's good that you do. And it can be about the smallest thing, you know. I remember when I used to do kung fu. I like martial arts. And I always figured I've got good kung fu feet. And I'm serious. Because they're short and fairly equal toes. And I can do a really good, and I really like martial arts. And I'd be arrogant about my feet. I'd be looking at all the other girls' feet, you know, the boys, because you have naked feet in martial arts, don't you? And I mean, this sounds absurd, but hear my point. I'd think, oh, my feet are better than theirs. A tiny point. Are you hearing me? My nose is better. Oh, I know more math. My ear's nice. I've got a better thing. I've got a better breast, you know. Whatever. I mean, it's really not joking. You're catching us because the irony of ego is we're separate from others. So we're always sort of pointing things out. You know, and when it's low self-esteem, you're miserable that people are better than you. And when you've got arrogance, you're kind of the self-importance. I remember Atisha, this Tibetan Indian scholar, actually, who spent years in Tibet back in the 11th century or something. I had this saying, and I think it could be the other way around, but it's really brilliant. He said, the best humility is patience. But he might have said, the best patience is humility. And it's a really good point. So and then we think of humility, we hear it like a dirty word. We hear it like low self-esteem. Totally wrong. The virtues are not distressing. They're not disturbing. They don't exaggerate. They're more in touch with dependent arising. Because when you have humility, you're delighting in another person's qualities. You're more focused on the other person. Not low self-esteem, but you're happy. You're content with yourself and you're happy for another person. So that's the antidote to arrogance. But you've got to catch the stories that they're telling us. It's very subtle. Are we communicating? Are we communicating?
Yeah.
Are we communicating? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Did I answer your question?
So you make a distinction between low self-esteem and arrogance. And arrogance means we exaggerate.
Low self-esteem exaggerates as well. So okay. Arrogance can collapse down to low self-esteem. Arrogance separates yourself from others and thinks you're more important. It'll be very subtle. And then as soon as you meet people who are better, you collapse into, oh, I'm no good. They're better than me. It's kind of, you understand what I'm saying? It's very subtle, but they're linked. They're very linked. Do you understand me?
Yeah,
does it make sense? Can you see that in your mind?
Yeah, so far I understand you.
Good, good, good. Yeah.
And how to stop this separation with others.
Between what?
Distinguishing I myself with other people.
Oh, sweetheart, this is when you finally achieved realization of emptiness and cut the root of delusions and no longer have a separate sense of self. Honey, way to go, okay? One step at a time. So this is why we've got to catch the branch, the root delusion, as we know, is this sense of a separate I. This is so subtle. We can talk about it. It's wonderful. And we must meditate on it. But if you work on the branch delusions first, attachment, anger, these ones, if we can calm these down, this makes it easier to get the root one. So one step at a time. So grab your, that's why we have to be aware of our thoughts, not just on the cushion, second by second, and that's what we get better and better at. And then you have to identify, because all these thoughts are like in a big soup. You know, for example, attachment and love is almost impossible to distinguish them. You know, love is a virtuous state of mind that delights in the happiness of someone else. Love is a joyful state of mind. It's connected to others. It makes you happy. It makes you make other people happy. But it's completely polluted by attachment, which is I-based, panic-stricken, neediness, expectation, possessiveness. It's really hard to see the difference. That's why first theoretically we should know the difference, and then slowly with self-awareness and our practice every day, you're catching your mind ever more subtle, ever more subtle, ever more subtle. Do you understand? It's a slow process.
Okay. So once I'm aware of the low self-esteem and the arrogance tendency, I just make a slight change, make it a little.
Well, Tibetans have a lovely saying. If you're feeling a bit arrogant, you remind yourself of something you can't do. It'll kind of calm you down. If you've got a bit of low self-esteem, you tell yourself something you can do. So you sort of pick yourself up. It's very sweet, but very meaningful. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Keep going.
Thank you.
Go on.
Landon, do we have any online questions?
Yes.
We do. Thank you, good. Venerable. The first online question is, how do we stop feeling self-pity when bad things happen in our life?
When bad things happen. Now, it's a simple question, but really so profound, you know. God. You see, the views of karma are fairly, they're almost like the first thing we learn about, you know, karma in Buddhism. And it sounds sort of, you know, don't kill, don't steal, don't lie, blah, 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 blah. But it's really profound. So all I can say is, you know, the more we try to apply the view of karma, that everything in your mind is from your own past tendencies, whatever happens to you is a fruit of your own past actions, even the way the physical environment impacts upon you. I mean, you know, it's like all of the things that, I mean, are a result of actions we've done in the past. So all we can do is learn it first, try to apply it, meditate on it sometimes, and then when bad things happen, the instinct of ego is so strong, and basically the instinct of ego is, how dare that happen to me? I don't deserve it. So really one answer to it, forget the karmic one, but the other answer to it is to really begin to hear this incredibly sophisticated, subtle relationship between attachment and anger. So, okay, the default neurosis in our mind, the Buddha says, is attachment. It's incredibly subtle. It goes to incredibly deep levels. So the general attitude of attachment is this emotional hunger that is always desperately wanting only the nice things. Try and hear this. It's just there as a default. You don't articulate it. But every second of the day, you're kind of this anxious hope that only nice things happen. The nice coffee, the nice taste, the nice husband, the nice sounds, the green lights, the pleasant weather. All the time, its attachment is wanting only the nice things. It can't cope with unnice things, is the point. The millisecond you stub your toe, the hubby slurps his coffee, the red light, the baby events, the millisecond attachment doesn't get what it wants. That's the arising of aversion. And that aversion is the bare bones state of mind that gives rise to the volatile anger, which basically is saying, how dare that happen to me? I don't deserve it. When you can hear that, that's what anger's saying. And anger is the response when the bad things happen. So then how dare that happen to me? I don't deserve it. That's the personification of self-pity. Not being rude. I mean, the life is terrible. Terrible things happen. We shouldn't make that light. I mean, terrible suffering happens. Look at what's going on in the planet. Unbearable things happen. So if anger is completely rampant, which it is, you can see, if anger is really powerful, it's 1,000,000% this sense that how dare that happen to me, and it's saying, I don't deserve it. This is not meant to be critical. This is why we suffer. This is analyzing what anger is. And where's it come from? The most primordial one of I only deserve the good things. So as long as attachment keeps getting the nice things, we have the hubris of assuming, well, of course only nice things should happen. That's what I deserve. Give me more, please. So the minute something goes wrong, that's what the self-pity is. And this is not being horrible because terrible things happen. Look at Israel. Look at Palestine. Look at the Ukraine. Look at anybody. Look at the homeless. I mean, anything you look at. But this is a deep analysis, Buddha's analysis of why we suffer, you know. So the self-pity one is very powerful and very instinctive and very programmed in our mind. So even understanding one, applying the law of karma, technically, and then the other one is simply learning to become familiar with the energy of attachment and aversion because they're intimately connected. We go between these two 1,000 times a day. Attachment isn't just getting excited about chocolate cake. That's a gross level. It's much more primordial. This is it's an assumption that I must get only the nice things. And it's quite fragile. And that's why we have anxiety. Anxiety is this constant fear the good thing mightn't happen and the constant fear that the bad thing will happen. That's what anxiety is. Like dog chewing with a bone, you know, panic stricken. We can't handle. That's why when we say control freak, that's attachment. Possessiveness, that's attachment. Emotional hunger, that's attachment. It's incredibly primordial and multifaceted, you know? And so it's the hunger to get only the nice things. It's like a fragile baby in there that only wants everything to be lovely. And then the millisecond the bad thing happens, panic attack. How dare that happen to me? I don't deserve it. So when we hear that analysis and try to unpack it, and realize it's irrational, it's normal, join the universe, but it's not rational. And when we go more deep, it's based upon no view of karma at all. In other words, the view we really have is, I didn't ask to get born. It's not my fault. That's the deepest sense of self-pity you can find. And that's the view we have. That's our materialist philosophical view. We even say it. You didn't ask to get born. Mummy and daddy made me. And that's, I mean, you don't want to criticize God if you're a Christian, although the Italians do. And the Italians here. They have the rudest words when things go wrong. I'd never criticize God. We're a Catholics. I never, never you did that. But I met an Argentinian. He said, we're even worse than the Italians. So that view, I mean, the view of karma is you kind of create yourself. So you can't say, I don't deserve it. If you create yourself, a simple example, if you have a bank account, you don't look in the bank account and say, how dare there be no dollars in my bank? I deserve dollars. That statement, does that not mean someone out there is supposed to put dollars, doesn't it? I deserve it. That's assuming that someone's running the show, isn't it? Do you agree with that? That someone should be putting money in your bank. That's a very bizarre idea. You know why? Because you created the bank account. You don't say, who put weeds in my garden? I don't deserve weeds. Because you know, and that's a really good example of karma, you know it's your garden. So you wouldn't say, I deserve or don't deserve. That's why that view, I don't deserve suffering and I deserve happiness, is quite bizarre for Buddha. If you really analyze karma and take it seriously as this amazing view that runs the universe. So in other words, in that point of view, whatever happens, as Lama Zopa puts it, it's our own karmic appearance. I mean, this really takes time to own, you know. But that's the application. You look at attachment and aversion. You look at karma. These are the antidotes. These are Buddha's view, which you're trying to internalize to the point of becoming experiential. So it's one step at a time, you know. You apply one step at a time. You can't fix it quickly because our minds are completely addicted to the view of no self-existence, you know, no emptiness, no cause and effect. That's how we suffer. That's what Buddha's telling us, you know. So it takes time. This is my answer. Who's next? Back at the back row, yeah. Thank you. Are we communicating, people? Yes. Good.
Thank you.
Okay, darling, talk to me.
Thank you very much, Shutok. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Great. So it's really good we had this last question because it sort of mine follows on. Can you hear me all right? Yep.
Go, darling.
I really struggle with this idea that, you know, babies who get raped,
sure, that's
murdered.
Right. Use the worst example, it's like a nightmare. I know, exactly.
Yeah.
So go on.
How karma fits into that? Somehow they've deserved this.
Okay. See, that's the point. You're the one using the word deserve.
I know.
That's the point.
Because
the,
you used it. I can understand it for myself. Nice little life.
No, I know. You don't understand it yourself. If someone comes and punches you in the nose, you won't understand it yourself. You say, "How dare you do that to me? I won't deserve it." We can say that theoretically, but basically, we say that because the view Buddha's saying the view in our mind now, which is inbuilt in us, is a view of no cause, no effect, innocent victims, didn't ask to get born, it's not my fault. That's the philosophical view in our mind. That's articulating the view already in our mind. Now, we don't think we have a view. Say this, it's good. We don't think we have a view, but it's so inbuilt, it's so automatic, and that's what we have to try and argue with. So, okay, now let me say something else to you. This little girl you just talked about, can I mention another little girl to you? So there's a little girl who's got a lovely mother and a lovely father and lovely, no one harms them. They've got a good education, a beautiful house, money in the bank. Are you telling me they deserve it? No, you missed the point. Of course they deserve it. We think nobody's ever asked me the question, why do good things happen to little girls? We only ever ask, why do bad things happen? Which shows we don't think even there's a cause for good things. But the fact that there's a child who's born into a good family, has a good body, has money in the bank, she absolutely created that. Every living being, every monkey, every dog, every ant, every human is having the life they created. That's the way to say karma. We only always ask it in terms of bad because we assume it's punishment. That's my exact point right at the beginning. It's deep in our bones.
But
did you hear me about the good little girl?
Yeah, I do. But
so every single thing that happens to any living being, Buddha's telling us our mind goes back and back and back and back and back to beginningless time. Every millisecond of what anything you've ever said, done, thought or heard or seen programs your mind, and every experience you have is the fruit of your past actions. That's the principal point. Don't talk about good or bad. That's the principle, and that's the one to think about. If you like Buddha's teachings, you don't have to, but that's what he's telling us.
It's that suffering that...
But only the suffering. But what about the happiness?
Well, it's produced from past actions.
Precisely. So is suffering and happiness are both produced from past actions. We're the boss. We're the creators of our reality.
So we don't have to worry about the suffering of little children because it's sort of the consequence of their past actions. No,
that's the view
actions.
The dual. So that's the view that we've all got. The first, as soon as we hear about karma and we see bad things, and then we hear that they must have created the cause, we then go, oh, well, screw them, they deserve it. That's the view we have. That's a view we have put on top of this view. That's not what Buddha's saying, but we hear it like that because we have an assumption that somehow somebody made us and it's all just good luck or bad luck and no one knows why. We have these views layered in our mind, sweetie, that we don't even know are viewpoints, and our questions are coming out of those viewpoints. So all we can do is listen to this and unpack it, look at it carefully. Do you hear my point? Yeah. It takes time. Yeah. But that's always the question we ask. But I've never yet had a person say, you mean that little girl who's beautiful and happy and has good mummy and good daddy, you mean she deserves it? It's like we don't even know what it means. We're a joke because we can't hear it. Are you seeing what I'm saying?
Mm. Yep.
But it's unbearable for us. Of course it is, because we have a view already of punishment. We have a view of innocent victims. I mean, even though the only compassion we have in the world is for a few dogs and children, but they've got to be innocent. So our view of punishment and happiness and suffering is very heavy. You've got to bloody well deserve it, mate. And if you don't, you know, that's why we only love people who are nice to us. So we can't stand people who are mean to us, because everything we think is deserved. It's so punitive. But it's got nothing to do with anything. Mm. It takes time to hear it, sweetheart. Mm. You don't have to like the view of karma. I mean, no, Buddha's not telling us to believe it. It's only if we want to apply it in our daily lives, you know. Do you understand? And because of my job, I've got to speak about it, then it helps me understand it, because I've got to unpack it, you know, because I want to understand it, because the view that I think is delicious, about the best view I've ever heard. The creative one doesn't make sense to me. The materialist one is just, you know, no answers there. I'm just talking. I'm not trying to be sectarian.
Thank you.
We're communicating, darling.
Yes.
So the one of the garden and the bank, can you see that? The analysis of the garden and the bank, you'd never say deserve, would you? Because that implies, you see, when you say deserve, it implies someone else is there and they should be putting the money in the bank, or someone else came along and put the weeds in your garden. But if you have the view of karma, everything, your life is like your garden. You see, if you speak to people who are really committed to the view of karma, like the Tibetans, for example, this is one example I always give. Back in 2003... And I was based in the States, I still am, and I was running the prison project, and Richard Gere invited the Dalai Lama, and he also decided to invite a bunch of ex-prisoners, about 20 of them, who'd all done some kind of meditation in prison, right? And they were like black, white, Puerto Rican, American, male, female. It was a very moving day. They met the Dalai Lama. They all talked about their suffering in prison. It was a very nice day, you know? So Richard Gere also invited two young Tibetan nuns. So you've got to see that, you've got to realize their background. Buddhism has been there like the 7th century. So the view of karma, which has been around for 5,000 years, you know, India, they don't do much about India now, but the Tibetans totally integrated into their being. It's in the bones of their being. You know, initially 98% of Tibetans were Buddhist. Now it's all changed, of course. But karma for them is the most natural view on the planet. They know it intimately. They take it for granted, just like we take materialism for granted. Are you seeing my point here? Or just like we take the view of creator. For them, it's utterly integrated into their lives, totally implicit. So because of that, they don't, you see, this is the only way to say it. These nuns, they were talking about their being tortured and sexual abuse, right? And it was evident to the Americans that they weren't angry. Now, we think they suppress. We think anger is healthy. But when you analyze, like I said before, try to unpack anger, what it's saying is, how dare you do that to me? I don't deserve it. And this is not being critical, but that is why we suffer unbearably in our lives. Because we have an assumption that someone made me, that I had no role in it, that I'm this innocent victim who got plonked on this planet by somebody else. I mean, no wonder we suffer if that's what we think is true. Are you hearing my point? So the Tibetans, these young women, they weren't angry. There were tears, but they don't have the concept in their head why is this happening to me? I don't deserve it. They have a view that is part of their practice that is the view of karma, integrated into their being. You have to understand that. So then fundamentally, emotionally, they're differently programmed from us because they just don't have that view. It's not, they're not suppressing. They simply don't have that view because they have an answer to why they're in this life, why good things happen, why bad things happen. It's very powerful. So then, of course, one of them, there was tears. And then she said, and of course, we had compassion for our torturers because we know we must have harmed them in the past and because we know they are going to suffer unbearably in the future. Now, that's incredible. But that's what's implied by this philosophical view of the universe that Lord Buddha tells us about, which is so utterly different, you know, from the creator one and utterly different from the materialist one. So it's quite a huge view. And it takes time, honey, to internalize it if we choose to. But that's why if we're going to say we're Buddhists, I mean, you can be a 1% Buddhist. It's okay. But if you want to go further, you've got to unpack this stuff. You can't just go shopping. Well, I don't like this. I don't like mindfulness, but I do like compassion. I mean, you can if you want to. Do you understand? But it's a very interesting holistic view of the universe, Buddha. It's kind of amazing. Okay, maybe I'm just fanatic, that's all. I'm a fanatic person. What can I say? Are we communicating here, people? Yes. Then, and when you realise you might like, in the end, we can choose. I mean, I've got all these friends in prison who became Buddhists. Then after a while they decided, no, thank you very much, and wrote back and said, no, I prefer Muslim now, Islam now. I think, all power to you, honey, you go for it. At least they're thinking about it, you know. At least they're thinking about it. Anyway, I'm chatting away here. Are we communicating? Okay. So go on, talk to me. Who else? Go.
Thank you, Venerable. The next online question is, how can those of historically poor behaviour turn to the Dhamma and reform?
Historically poor behaviour. Well, my friends in prison, these Mexican gangsters, they're good examples. I mean, this is the irony of it. You know, there they were. Now let me use my own self as an example first. This is a good example. There we were. I was on my family of seven people, seven kids, my mother and father, nine of us all together, all very close in age, us sisters and everything, my brother. And I was naughty. I was just one of the naughty ones. You know, I was naughty. I got angry easily. I'd fight with my sisters. I was a bully. And because it was kind of intense being seven human beings together. We didn't have enough beds. They had babies so quickly we ran out of beds, you know. And she sent us to Sacré-Cœur, one of the expensive convents. And the poor things couldn't keep up with the bills probably. I joked that my mother still owes the bills after 60 years, right? I mean, I was talking. So it was a very intense environment. So I was naughty. It brought out, I'm not blaming anybody, it brought out the worst in me. Shouting, yelling, angry, upset. I mean, we had to share beds and two of my sisters had asthma. So I'd get so upset when Judy slept with me, I couldn't sleep, so I put a pillow on her head. I mean, of course it's mean. But I was, you understand that I was so naughty at some point. I was about 13 or 12, I can't remember. I can't work it out that it was the same time I wanted to be a nun. It seems a bit weird, but apparently, I mean, it was about, maybe I was 12, 11, I don't remember. But all I know is my mother found me with her high heels. I was walking down Murrumbina Road, when we lived in Murrumbina, with a full skirt on, pink lippy and some lips and some earrings I got from Woolies or something, trying to seduce the greengrocer's son, you know. So she freaked out completely and she sent me to live at school, sent me to boarding school. Well, because I love God, overnight I became a saint. So suddenly you put me in a new environment where I had my own bed, I had discipline, I went to mass every day. A new person came out of that. That's the answer first. That's why environment is so powerful. I didn't have the ability as a child to behave better in that crazy environment of many children. But you put me in an environment where I was more disciplined, it was like a miracle. A new part of me came. So that's exactly what I find with my Mexican gangsters. So many of these guys lived stealing, I mean, raping and killing. That's what you do as a Mexican gangster. You kill the men and rape the girls. But now it's equal, they kill the girls as well. And I'm just joking, but I'm not joking. So many of the people I first met in prison were these Mexican gangsters from Los Angeles. So there they were in that environment. They knew nothing else. But you put them in prison and then they go into their single cell in isolation because they've been so bad in prison. Then these intelligent, the ones with intelligence and a connection with the Dharma, and quite a few have, they've got big hearts. This whole new person is manifesting and they become some of the best practitioners I've known. So one of the answers is, you know, put yourself in the right condition and that can nourish the right part of yourself. Not everybody. Some people are so, their minds are so berserk, no matter what conditions they have, they're still so deluded. But you have to at least find that out, you know. That's a very powerful step, first. It's just, it's obvious. If you're trying to give up alcohol, you stop joining up, you stop talking to alcoholics. You hang around with non-alcoholics. Then it helps you, you know. But I mean, so the mind is the point, but the external conditions are so powerful. Whereas in the world, we only think the external conditions are the point, you know. So that's a really, that's a good point, that one. And I mean, it was so, for me, the Mexican gangsters, it's so clear. This whole new part of them was able to be nourished because they had a new condition. They got out of the gangs, you know. It's the irony of being in prison. Some became the best practitioners, I can tell you, you know. It's amazing. What else? You better tell me when to stop. It's a quarter to nine.
Yeah.
20 to nine. We've got till nine, have we?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
There's this lady.
Oh, it's okay.
Okay. Go,
question. Go,
sweetheart. Yes.
Hi. Thank you so much for your teachings.
Good.
We're so happy to see you.
What?
We're so happy to see you.
We've been, I'm happy to see you.
My husband and I are so happy to see you. We've been like following you for so very long our Dharmic journey. So we're really excited. But you were talking about Buddha before, and that got me thinking. And I was really curious what you would think if Buddha was around like today, now.
Yes, sure.
What do you think he would think of all of us? And what do you think would be the one teaching that he would give to us that would be most appropriate for
today?
Yeah,
that's a really important point, isn't it? It's a really good question, actually. You know, I mean, I remember one asking one teacher, it happened to be a Tibetan, what's one instruction you give people? He said, don't kill. And I think because killing is the heaviest one of harming, you know. So, I mean, this is where it's so interesting. When we look at Buddha's time, for example, sexual misconduct in Buddha's time, I mean, is, you know, it's considered naughty to do this and this and this, but you look at the world now where there's so much insanity and so much craziness and so much raping and so much cheating, it almost seems like a joke to say don't sleep with someone else's wife when people are sleeping with dogs. And I'm not being horrible here. Please hear my point. We are so deluded now, you know. So God knows what I'm a Buddha. I mean, I still think he'd probably give the same advice. But, I mean, Lord knows what aspect he would take because the world's like an insane asylum. I mean, delusions are just insane and rampant and berserk and out of control. He's not being mean.
Do you think it's a lot more rampant than what it was during his time?
I mean, are you saying
I don't know. I wasn't there.
No, listen, I think delusions are delusions. And they've been since the beginning of this time, attachment, anger, jealousy. But, I mean, if I just think of Tibet, 10th century Tibet, I mean, it says in one of the verses about particular practices where we try to use problems as a way of practicing, one of the verses says something about when you hear it, just hear about this, a really, basically, this is not the right words, but a crazy person who's like, it's like really negative and really suffering, then you have compassion for them. I mean, that means it's a psychopath. Now, I mean, that psychopath is a word we use, and I think the world is full of crazy. I mean, everywhere you turn, you're going to find psychopaths. But it said the rare person you might hear about. The rare person you might hear about. But now, today, you hear some of the insanity of what people do. Sexually, people sleep around, they sleep up, they go this end, they go that end, they sleep with animals. I mean, have you heard about furries? Have you heard this deluded world? I'm not being this is the world now. There's really more attachment, children have sex, and I mean, I'm not being rude about sex even. Just our minds are berserk because we're so dissatisfied. So we try this and we try that, and we try this and we try that, with this insanity. Look at the conspiracy theories. Look at the crazy views. Look at the politicians. And we're so more sophisticated in our violence now. I mean, they didn't have bombs back then. They might have a gun or a knife, you know. I mean, it's just more rampant now. It surely is. Surely is. Am I right? You know, I think most, if you came from the 10th century to now, you'd have a mental breakdown instantly. You think you got, were born in the hell realms, you forgot, you got the wrong place, you know. So, I mean, I think Buddhist teachings wouldn't change. I mean, look at me, I'm speaking pure Buddhism here. I mean, I'm not trying to be rude, but I am, even though it's an Australian accent. This is clean, straightforward Buddhist teachings. So then maybe they won't change, but then I think it's the structure of them. And I think we can all hear this. Because it's practical psychology. It's practical. It's practical. So maybe he wouldn't be, he'd just speak it differently, you know, probably.
Yeah.
But it has to be the same in the end.
Yeah.
Can't be different. Yeah. There's something authentic in Buddha's teachings. It can't change over cultures.
Yeah,
you'd emphasize different things. You know, you'd be adjustable, but not the fundamentals of... See, that's why Buddha's so amazing, because he talks about natural law, not his law, natural law, which killing all the natural negativities, basically the actions that harm others. They come from attachment and aversion and the others. That's fundamental scientific truth. That'll never change. Just that it changes the way, the shape of it. That's what I'm saying. So I think it wouldn't be any different. Just speak it differently. Show a different aspect, maybe. He might even show the aspect of being a monk still. I mean, maybe. I mean, I'm a nun, you know. I think it's not so weird in the world. I don't know. That's a good point. Yes.
Next online question.
Yep.
Next online question. I'm going to apologize to Jay Morgan. I feel your question has already been answered. So I'm going to get the next question. It's quite different. What is the relationship between the mind and the brain in terms of all sentient beings, especially humans?
Well, that's interesting because Buddha's view is very clear. Okay, we state what he says. Consciousness or mind, these words are broadly synonymous. Is that word refers to your internal, subjective, cognitive process itself, which includes thoughts, angry ones and positive ones, emotions, unconscious, subconscious, instinct, intuition, this entire spectrum of your inner being. That's your mind. And it's not physical. It is not the handiwork of a creator. It is not the handiwork of your parents, and therefore is not a function of the brain. So the way I'd put it, without insulting neuroscientists, is that the brain is a physical indicator of what is going on in your mind. But only at a grosser level, because these genius Indians, remember, you know, discovered samadhi, that you can do by doing shamatha meditation. You can go beyond conceptuality, beyond the sensory consciousness, to a much subtler level of mind, your cognition, that doesn't depend upon a brain. So that's since Indians have discovered that. So mind is way more subtle, we imagine. It is, and the brain is a physical indicator of what is going on in the mind at a grosser level. That's the answer, I'd say. And then you do get your brain from your mum, and you get your genes from your mum, and your DNA, and all of the physical. Yes, no problems. But the karmic view is, due to my past, like for, you know, due to my past tendency to kill, let's say, I'll get born... No, due to my past tendency to be angry, let's say, I'll get born to a mummy who gets angry. So then they say, oh, well, Rabina's angry because her mum's angry. No, my mum's angry because she practiced anger before. I'm angry because I practiced anger before, and we conveniently came together to increase each other's anger. I mean, I'm good at, my mother was a musician. And then they say, oh, then she saw her little Bobsy, that's me. Oh, Rabina's good at music. Well, not because of her mum's genes, no. I practiced music before, she practiced music before, and we came together, and then she happened to nourish my music. Cancer, you, due to your past killing, you get one of the consequences of any action is you have the physical, you know, what we are physically has come from past karma too. So the physical result of past, one of the physical results of past killing, it's called environmental result, is that you get born to a mummy who's got genes where you've got the tendency to get cancer. They're her genes, but you create the cause due to your past killing to get those genes. So you create the cause to have that. You bring the anger with you. You bring the jealousy with you. So the brain and the body, yep, come from mum and dad, but our mind is our own. It's just a question of putting these things together because they seem initially contradictory, you know. I hope that answers the person's questions. Yes, something else. Somebody here. In the front row, Kerry. Go, darling.
I'm just wondering to cheer us up.
Oh, all right, Kerry.
Where do we go? Because all these babies that are getting beheaded, if that's their karma that's coming in, once they're out of this body, do they then come back? Yeah. To something better, does
okay.
it stop
I
that
darling.
Old karma?
Well, I think the thing, the feeling I've got in my Buddha's teachings, the thing that's encouraging, which we need to hear, so let's talk about it, that there are trillions of sentient beings, trillions of minds. The term in Tibetan for sentient being is semchen, mind possessor. There are trillions of mind possessors. Some of us are in the human realm. And then there are four ways that our past karma ripens in the present. One is a type of rebirth. So getting a human body is like a miracle because it's the fruit of past non-killing. Then you've got the second way your karma ripens, which is your tendencies within that body, your good tendencies, your bad tendencies. The third is called experiences similar to the cause, the result of what you've done before, good and bad. And the fourth is even called environmental. So the point that's for me encouraging, so karma is an explanation of why babies get their heads blown off. Karma is also an explanation of why a baby doesn't get her head blown off, why she isn't, it's not just random. One baby is due to her virtue, keeps her head intact, okay, has a nice mother. We tend to only, so okay, the hopeful thing for me is Buddha's fundamental view that mind in its nature is clear and pure, that this mind of ours, this consciousness of ours has this unbelievable potential to be radiant and blissful and clear, and that can never go. That can never, 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 never go. So here we are going through these dramas of life after life, but always this energy of ours is this potential to be totally radiant, totally liberated, totally pure. And that's, if we can have that view ourselves and that gives us encouragement to want to be of benefit to others, then we can stay buoyant. Then we can stay optimistic, is the best I can say. Because the world is a terrible suffering place. How can we ever, 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 ever deny it? But we have to have some optimism because the fact that the mind is innately pure, okay, that's the Mahayana view, Buddha nature and things, then it gives you encouragement to never give up. Then you have encouragement in the face of suffering. I remember Martin Luther King, I was always impressed. He said, it's good to see the terrible suffering in the world. It's good to find fault. But then you say, what can I do to help? If we don't have that, we will all drown in despair, you know. So every being has countless karmic seeds. Yes, terrible suffering happens. But if we can also realize that, you know, for example, one of my friends, years and years of meditation, serious meditation retreats, and at some point he's out of his brain with rage and despair. And we're just talking mental suffering, not having his head blown off. And he was really distressed. And he went to Lama Zopa and Rinpoche said, fantastic, fantastic. The dirt has to come out. The dirt has to come out. So in the long-term progress of a person, having their head blown off in one life might have purified 40 million eons of garbage and next life they become an enlightened being. So there's more to it than appears. And I mean, it doesn't mean you just take it lightly. But people have got their paths, you know, and you just don't know. I mean, for him, it was a liberating thing to hear that he's all the shit's coming out because he's working so hard at himself. So there's more ways than seeing it, you know, and then it keeps us encouraged. And all we can do is do what we can in front of that ant, that dog, that human right there. If we can go to Ukraine and stop the war, if we can go and fix it up in Palestine, please go. But you know what I'm saying? But we know we can't. So we just have to have compassion, understand about karma, use it as a teaching for ourselves. I'm not going to kill again. I'm not going to steal again. I'm not going to lie. Look at the suffering. I don't want that. And keep moving and keep trying to help. Otherwise, you'll go mad. We will go mad. That's why people do go mad. Do you understand? That's my feeling, Kerry. What do you think, people? What do we do? I mean, otherwise you just close our eyes and don't read the news, you know. Or go back to 10th century Tibet when you might hear about one wacko way over the other village, you know. Might.
Fine. Yeah, 5 more minutes. So we have one online question. So one.
Go talk to me.
All right. The next online question is, how do we reconnect with the world after extreme trauma?
So start the second sentence, what?
How do we reconnect with the world after extreme trauma rather than hiding from the world?
Oh, that's a very good question. That's a really good point, yeah. First of all, let's look at what trauma is. You're taking this Buddhist analysis, and because the world is so suffering, we're all going to have trauma. Trauma, basically, I think, is, you know, if we understand this attachment and aversion, which sounds so cute to us, but it really is primordially deep. We're driven by this hunger, this emotional hunger to only have nice things, which is attachment. It can't cope with anything not being nice. And then the millisecond a bad thing happens, then the degree of your attachment for only nice things equals the degree of your panic attack when the bad thing happens, which is aversion. So depending on your personality, if you're an angry, volatile person, you might kick and shout, which means some part of you deals with it so you'll have less trauma. And you might also harm other people, but you don't repress it. But other people who are more quiet, more kind, more sweet will have a panic attack and immediately bury it and not deal with it because it's too painful. So trauma is undealt with pain, basically. And we can't make it go away because it's going to be buried. So the sooner, so the learning from that is, even, it sounds so silly, but please hear the point. The tiniest thing that attachment doesn't want, like stubbing your toe, think of something as simple as that. The moment you stub your toe, aversion, anger arises, right? So if you deal with it then, argue with it, relax with being, it's just a bit of pain, there's no trauma. You don't carry it on because everything stays in the mind. So that is how you train yourself to deal with the rubbish things when they happen. You greet the red light. You greet the mean word. You deal with it. Therefore, there's no trauma. So if we can, then we, of course, we go our past lives and had trauma, had terrible things happen. Then if we are dealing with it, then you go back into the world gently. That's all. You have loving friends. You have good people who support you. But learn not to be afraid. Learn to know that attachment can't cope with problems and aversion has a panic attack. So we can learn to know our mind well and be able to learn then to greet the baby problems and then solve them, then there is no trauma. And I'm not trying to be sarcastic or joking, you know. It's not simplistic. It's incredible. But Buddha has this amazing analysis, you know, of our minds. And if we can use that, we can become braver. And then when we are more brave, we can then confront the problem. So just to give an extreme example, because it's kind of outrageous, I'll finish with this one story. Working with people in prison, okay? This one person I always talk about, Sunny. Her name is Sunny Jacobs. She wrote a memoir. She's not a Buddhist. She's not a Christian. She's nothing. She's got no particular view. She talks about the universe, you know? She was there. She was hitching in Florida with a couple of kids and her husband in the 70s. They get picked up by two guys. The guys got stopped by the police. The guys kill the police and blame the hippies. So she and her husband are on death row. She's in a cell on her own. They give her a Bible. I mean, it's so like medieval, you know. Husband eventually gets executed. First of all, she loses her kids. They were given to her parents. Then her parents died in a car accident. Her kids were given to the state. Then her husband was executed. She was at the execution and his head burst into flames. One nightmare after another. One nightmare after another. In her own cell, on her own, with nothing and nobody. And you can only imagine the nightmare. And I know so many people who go mad in prison because you cannot deal with anything and you're not equipped and you don't know how to do it, you know. So she somehow had this, the only way I can put it, she had no spiritual path. She had no access to any books. She had no teachers. But all she had was this astonishing emotional intelligence, is the only way I can put it, that enabled her to see, as she said, I finally realized I couldn't change anything, but they couldn't take my mind from me. So she said different things, but one thing she said, she's out of prison now, and I know her. I can't get over her. She's so amazing. She said, I realized that I had to take responsibility for what was in my own mind. So what do you think was in her mind? Grief, rage, despair, going crazy, anger beyond bearing, you know? And she realized that the events out there were one thing and her mind was another, and she could work on her mind. So she said, I'd give myself, in this process of transforming herself, using her own methodology, she learned yoga, she used her own methods. She said, I'd give myself permission to be raging angry for 5 minutes and then I would stop. And she'd go back to her inner work. This is so insane. I can't get over this woman, you know. So what I'm trying to get to, because of that, she doesn't have trauma because she was able somehow to find the means to deal with these nightmares presented to her. You know? She has no view of karma. She has no view of a creator. She just had this extraordinary ability. So what I'm saying is trauma, we've all got it because we're not equipped. Since little children, terrible things have happened. And the degree that we can't deal with it, that we can't confront it, that we can't see it, is the degree to which we will bury it and carry it. And that's what trauma is. And most of us are suffering from it in one degree or another, you know. But if we can learn to deal with things, don't go back in the past, deal with stuff now, then you develop this skill to confront problems, to face the problem, not to push it away. Because problem is what attachment doesn't want. So she just has such an extreme example. So I thought I'd end with that.
Yes. Thank you very much, Venerable, for your profound insight. And
Buddha's is Buddha. I'm just his mouthpiece. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay. I think we finished tonight. It's really Venerable is quite tired now, so we pay our respect. And if you would, when you make your exit, there's a box there, Dana, for Venerable.
No, I'll keep it for the center. I don't want it.
Oh, thank you very much.
Give it to the monastery.
Oh yes.
Okay.
Okay. Thank
Buy
you.
Buy a candle or something. Or
yeah. Okay, it will
or
be
breakfast
used.
Breakfast for the monks, I don't know.
All donations that we collect today will go towards Newbury General Fund, because we have a high electricity bill there. It's cold there.
Yeah, that's good. I'm wonderful. So. Happy for that. Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to sing a prayer, just a tiny prayer. Okay. May compassion grow and grow in the hearts of all. That's all. And courage, maybe courage as well. Tiny prayer. Chang chob sem chog rinpoche ma ke panam ke guchig ke panyam pa me payang gong ne gong du pelva shok. That's it. Thank you. Very short. Thank you, darling.
Thank you.
Good.